Let's continue in Joshua chapter 2 and the story of Rahab, the prostitute slash innkeeper of Jericho. Now, Joshua has sent two spies to scout the way and check out the defenses of Israel's crossing point over the Jordan River. And the first city they're going to encounter in enemy territory, which is Jericho. Now, the encampment of Israel is at this point waiting on the east side of the Jordan River at a place called Shittim, means acacia trees, right, in Moab. And they're waiting for the spies to return so battle plans can be formulated. Let's reread Joshua chapter 2. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is on page 243, Joshua chapter 2. We'll read the whole chapter. Joshua, the son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim with these instructions: go and inspect the land and Jericho. They left and they came to the house of a prostitute named Rahab, and they spent the night. The king of Jericho was told about it. Tonight some men from Israel came here to reconnoiter the land. The king of Jericho sent a message to Rahab: bring out the men who came to you and are staying in your house, because they've come to reconnoiter all the land. However, the woman, after taking the two men and hiding them, replied, yes, the men did come to me, but I don't know where they come from. The men left around the time when they shut the gate, when it was dark. Where they went, I don't know, but if you chase after them quickly, you'll overtake them. Actually, she had brought them up to the roof, hidden them under some stalks of flax she had spread out there. The men pursued them all the way to the fords at the Yarden, the Jordan. As soon as the pursuit party had left, the gate was shut. Now the two men had not yet lain down when she returned to the roof and said to them, I know that Adonai has given you the land. Fear of you has fallen on us. Everyone in the land is terrified at the thought of you. We've heard how Adonai dried up the water in the Sea of Suf ahead of you when you left Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amori, the Amorites, on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, that you completely destroyed them. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts failed us. Because of you, everyone's in a state of depression. For Adonai, your God, he is God in heaven above and on the earth below. So please, swear to me by Adonai that since I have been kind to you, you will also be kind to my father's family. Give me some evidence of your good faith, that you will spare the lives of my father, mother, brothers, and sisters, and all who are theirs, so that we won't be killed. And the men replied to her, our lives are certainly worth yours, provided you don't betray our mission. So when Adonai gives us the land, we'll treat you kindly and in good faith. Then she lowered them by a rope through the window, since her house abutted the city wall. Indeed, it was actually built into it. She told them, head for the hills so that the pursuit party won't get their hands on you, and hide yourselves there for 3 days until the pursuers have returned. After that, you can go on your way. The men said to her, we will not be guilty of violating the oath you made us swear, provided that when we enter the land, you tie this piece of scarlet cord in the window you let us down from. And you gather together in your house your father, mother, brothers, and your father's entire household. And if anyone goes out the doors of your house into the street, he will be responsible for his own blood, and we will be guiltless. But everyone who stays with you in the house, we will be responsible for his blood if anyone lays a hand on him. However, if you say a word about this business of ours, then we'll be free of your oath that you made us swear. According to your words, so be it, she said, and sent them away. As they departed, she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They left, arrived in the hills, and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers had returned. The pursuers had searched for them all the way, but hadn't found them. Then the two men returned, and descending from the hills, they crossed over and came to Joshua the son of Nun, reported everything that had happened to them. Truly Adonai has handed over all the land to us, they told Joshua. Everyone in the land is terrified that we're coming. Two Israelite spies have infiltrated the city of Jericho. And they're now holed up in the Traveler's Inn run by Rahab. Now, I'm going to continue calling this place an inn and not a house of prostitution, because more and more it seems likely that it was primarily an ancient hostel, if you would. All right, although it equally is likely that prostitution took place there as a matter of course and an expected service, actually. Now, usually in the Bible, when a house is associated with a person and it's designated as a house of prostitution, it says the house of so-and-so. In our case, it ought to be the house of Rahab. We don't find that phrase here. Further, there's utterly no implication of sexual activity between these two spies and Rahab. And as those of you who have gone through the Torah with me are aware, the Bible is not at all shy about dealing rather explicitly with sexual matters. In verse 3, the king of Jericho accuses Rahab of harboring these two Israelite spies. Now, there's no doubt the king had been expecting just such a thing, because everyone within a couple of hundred miles knew where the Israelites were camping, and they knew about their intention to conquer the land of Canaan. I mean, after all, you can't move 3 million people around in secret. Now, not only that, but it was by then common knowledge that Canaan was the Hebrews' destination, because they had always openly stated it. So the only open question was where Israel would cross the Jordan and attack first, and when. It is apparently that the king's soldiers had been keeping a wary eye on the various travelers that regularly entered Jericho. So they knew the Israelites were coming. They were looking for this. Now, Rahab's response to the soldiers is really quite ironic. She sides with the spies. She also hides them at great personal risk so that the king's men won't find them. And then she lies to the soldiers. And she says that although these two men had been at her inn, they're gone now. And further, she really didn't know who they were or where they were from. She explains that at about the time of the daily shutting of the city gates, the men went out of the city and they haven't returned. Well, the city gates of walled cities in that area were usually shut about nightfall, just as we tend to close our windows, lock our doors as darkness approaches, because in all eras and all lands, nighttime is when predators, animal and human, seek their prey. Well, after convincing the king of Jericho's soldiers that the two spies had left via the city gates, Rahab goes up to the roof where the men are in hiding. And now the roofs of houses in that era, and still actually very much so in the Middle East and in third world countries today, they were used for a variety of practical purposes. In the summer heat, the roof was typically where some or all of the family slept. The roof was sometimes the guest area. It was offered to strangers passing through as a place to spend the night. Or it was used as a place to hang and cure meat, or like in our story, to spread out plant material to dry. In this case, it was flax. Now, since flax was cut into long stalks when it was harvested, spread thickly on a flat surface to dry, it made an excellent hiding place. Now, it's interesting. The Bible never condemns Rahab for her blatant lies to her government authorities. Actually, her faith is even held up for admiration. She's even favorably compared to some of the great deliverers of Israel by the writer of the New Testament book of Hebrews. In Hebrews 11:30, we read, "By trusting, the walls of Jericho fell down after the people had marched around them for 7 days. By trusting, Rahab the prostitute welcomed the spies and therefore did not die along with those who were disobedient. What more should I say? There isn't time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Shimshon, Samson, Iftach, David, Shmuel, Samuel, and all the prophets. Now, although the Bible does not condemn Rahab for lies, neither does it excuse it. See, often it is said that because she was a pagan Canaanite and a whore, that the Lord didn't have any expectation of her to be a truthful person, so neither does the Bible. But there's no indication of that viewpoint in the Word of God. I think that while we should not necessarily admire Rahab's lies, neither should they bother us very much. I mean, she was confronted with a situation that most of us have been faced with during our lives, to lie or risk hurting someone. Now, sadly, it's but the state of the world in which we live, that we must constantly find ourselves having to choose between the lesser of two evils. Or let me put that more succinctly. Do we commit a greater sin or a lesser sin? Because at times, like here for Rahab, there's really no middle ground. Had she told the truth, those men of Israel would have been discovered. They would have been executed, and Joshua would have had to try something else. Now, one of the great doctrinal errors of some streams of Christian denominational thought is that a sin is a sin is a sin. One sin is as bad as any other sin. Stealing a loaf of bread is no different than committing adultery. Worshipping idols is no worse than going 40 and a 35. They're all sin, so what does it matter? Well, this is just patently anti-scriptural. Further, how does one choose, when you're confronted with it, between the lesser of two evils, if there is no greater and lesser? See, there's countless sad tales of Christians turning in their Jewish neighbors in wartime Germany, saying that it would have been a sin to lie to the authorities. So they had no choice but to do the Christian thing, send these innocent Jews to Nazi death camps. Rahab is a great illustration to point out the absurd notion of making the subject of sin and its consequences so simplistic. And the writer of Hebrews goes so far as to hold Rahab up as a godly example of weighing out the best of two bad choices. Now, Rahab must have been believable, maybe even considered trustworthy, because the soldiers immediately leave the city and they go hunting for these two spies. They go all the way to the natural and well-known fording points of the Jordan, yet another indication they knew exactly where Israel was and of their intent to cross the Jordan into the Canaan. And as the soldiers left the city, the gates were shut behind them so that the spies would be trapped if they were still inside the city, and then blocked from re-entry if they'd gone out. Now comes this profound and unexpected moment of Rahab's confession of faith in the God of Israel. It's here that we learn the why between Rahab's risky protection of two Hebrew men who were complete strangers to her. She begins with the words, "I know. I know. I know," she says, "that the Lord has given Israel this land. I know it." Of course, this is referring to her land, the very place she lives and her ancestors lived as Canaanites. Actually, the Hebrew does not have Rahab say that the Lord gave Israel the land. It says, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yehovah, or Yahweh, gave Israel the land. See, Rahab was actually familiar with the personal name of the God of Israel. Now, believe me when I tell you that merely knowing the name of Israel's God was nothing supernatural. It wasn't particularly outstanding. People of that era had great interest in the names of the gods of the various nations because it was considered an important thing to know. Jehovah's name was known far and wide just as Molech's name, the god of the Canaanites, was known far and wide. But those simple words, "I know," also indicate her unequivocal belief, especially on an intellectual level, of what she was about to say. She didn't suspect, she didn't guess, she didn't waffle back and forth. She knew. And what she knew began with what was indisputable fact to her: Jehovah, the God of Israel, had already turned her land, Canaan, over to the Israelites. Now, that is a confession of faith that has a significant portion of modern-day believers who would do well to remember and to repent of its more current prevalent view that maybe God didn't give that land to Israel after all. And if he did, it happened so long ago it's not relevant anymore. Rahab goes on that the people of Canaan are in a state of depression and they're fearful because they know that Israel's coming and that the chances of defeating them are slim to none. Why did the Canaanites think that? Although it doesn't say so, the sheer numbers of Israel's 600,000 man army were overwhelming. But on another level, what Rahab confides to the spies is that everyone has heard about the parting of the Red Sea for Israel to pass through when they came from Egypt. Everyone in Canaan had heard what had happened to Sihon and Og, whom the Israelites destroyed. So the minute that the people of Canaan heard about these events, they immediately gave credit to Israel's God, Jehovah. And man, they knew they were in trouble. They lost all hope. As it says in verses 11 and 12, Jehovah your God, he is God of heaven and he's God on earth. See, that last statement kind of slips by us, but it shouldn't. Saying that Jehovah is both God of heaven and God of earth is quite a confession for someone in that era. There were gods then whose only realm was heaven, and there were gods whose only realm was earth. But there was no single Babylon mystery religion god that was God of heaven and earth. In order for there to exist in the mind of the people of that era the monotheistic notion of only one God, it meant that a paradigm that had been understood since time immemorial had to be overturned. And that was that the God of earth was separate from the God of heaven. Rather, by all, even Hebrew understanding, there was God, one God who had authority over both realms, or both realms of existence now. Now, we'll see the phrase God of heaven and earth continue right on into the New Testament era, not because the Hebrews still thought that two separate gods ruled heaven and earth, but because in Greek thought and language, and it was Greek thought and language that dominated the world at that time, that these two realms must, by definition, have two separate gods. We use that same phrase in songs and in worshipful declarations today, but we only use it in the poetic sense. 2,000 years ago and more, the Jews who said God of heaven and earth meant it literally as a way to differentiate between Hebrew and pagan beliefs. Now let me summarize what's just happened. Rahab just stood up and walked the aisle. Rahab just declared the authority of the God of Israel in her life. She declared that he is God of heaven and earth, and since there's no other known realms for a God to govern, then Jehovah is the only God for her to bow down to. Rahab trusted the Lord, and it was credited to her as righteousness. Her faith was very simple, but it was also very practical. Now, she didn't know much about the God of Israel other than he had given her homeland of Canaan to the Hebrews and that he defeated and destroyed all who opposed him, but that was enough for her. From a practical sense, she knew she didn't want to be on the wrong side of this battle or that God. She didn't want to be an enemy of God's people because in her mind, the end results were certain and terrible because of their God. This was not a convert now, repent later attitude that Rahab possessed. It wasn't an attempt to deceive the spies, although they rightfully expressed skepticism about her pronouncement. This is proved by her putting her freedom and life on the line by concealing these enemy spies and then lying to her governmental authorities about it all and then even helping Joshua's men to escape. I mean, I said that this was a practical act of faith. And we see that out of all this, Rahab wanted something. She wanted something in return. She wanted her family. She wanted herself to be spared. When Israel, and therefore Israel's God, won. Now, folks, what better expression of the purpose and outcome of the gospel can we find than this? Anyone who comes to Messiah Yeshua without understanding what a practical and self-saving decision and commitment they have made really ought to be questioned. We should be coming to Yeshua understanding what Rahab understood. You either submit to the God of Israel or you're going to be destroyed. The destruction may not be immediate, it may not be physical. But it is certain. We should understand that he is the God of heaven and earth. And that while an idealistic view of a peaceful, utopian, eternal future with him is important, we still have an earthly life to live. In some cases, suffer through it. And Yehovah is God of our earthly life, and he's God of our heavenly life. Now in verse 14, the two spies agreed that in return for helping them, they would save her and her family from the coming onslaught, but there were conditions. She could not wait until they were gone and then tell the authorities in order to cover her tracks. Even their oath to Rahab is like the gospel, our life for yours. They are making an oath to Rahab that not only will they protect her, but also that if anything happens to any of her family, they will forfeit their lives for that failure. Rahab's house abutted the city wall, such that a window into her house, probably it was above the roof, was actually a small hole in the city's outer wall. Now, houses built virtually into the outer wall of a city were usual and customary. For one reason, it meant that at least one wall of the home was already built, and it was a very sturdy wall. Now, building a stone dwelling was backbreaking work, and it took quite a while. Stones had to be gathered, trimmed, transported, placed. That's why the rubble from previous homes and buildings was always the first choice for building material for those who built anew upon the ruins of the old. Now, out of that window, Rahab dropped a rope for the men to climb down and escape. But before that, she instructed where they were to hide for a while. She told them to go to the nearby mountains. Now, anybody who's ever been to Jericho understands this suggestion immediately. The mountains near Jericho are due west, and Rahab had observed the king's soldiers going due east to check out the fording areas of the Jordan River. And further, these hills are riddled with caves to hide in, and they provide shelter. Stay there for 3 days, she instructs, until the soldiers return. Then it'll be safe for the two spies to return to Joshua. But the spies want to make something very clear, because they have pledged their lives in this bargain. They have sworn to Rahab, invoking the name of Jehovah, so they want to be certain that Rahab understands that there are conditions upon her. Otherwise, they claim the pledge is going to be invalidated. Rahab has to do three things. She has to hang that same rope, but with a scarlet thread wound around it, out of the same window, to indicate to Israel's soldiers which house they are to protect and they're to spare. Second of all, when Joshua's army surrounds the city, Rahab must quickly gather her family to her inn, because only those who are physically with her will be protected. And third, her family must remain there until these two spies personally come to fetch them. If any of them go out into the city streets prematurely, they're going to be killed, right along with all the other inhabitants of Jericho. And to all of this, she agreed. Now, Christianity has always suspected that this scarlet thread was significant. The color red usually signifies one of two things in the Bible: blood and or redemption. Now, I think it's not off the mark to say that the red thread coming out of Rahab's window is the equivalent of the red blood painted on the doorposts of the Israelite homes in Egypt at the first Passover. Very similar. Similar symbolism. The idea being that death will pass over. It'll bypass the family that displays it. So I feel very comfortable seeing the scarlet thread as a symbol of redemption for Rahab and her family. But there's more. Now, I won't go into depth at the moment for one reason. We've discussed this before. We'll have more opportunities to revisit this in later lessons. But at the heart of everything that is occurring in this story, and it's going to occur, the conquest of Canaan, is holy war. Holy war. And at the heart of holy war is the law of harem in English. That's called, in English, it's called the law of the ban. Harem in Hebrew means ban in English. And at the heart of holy war, harem is the key to it, because it's about spoils of war. The principle is that in true holy war, as initiated and led by God, Israel is not entitled to the usual spoils of war that accompany a military victory. Rather, all the spoils of holy war belong to the Lord. The people are banned, harem, from those spoils because they're holy property. In addition to the valuable materials like gold and silver and flocks and herds, are the defeated people themselves, who are also considered spoils of war. In most wars, the people were taken as slaves, servants, or even added to the conqueror's own army in some cases. But in holy war, there was really only one way for God to receive those spoils of war. The spoils had to be destroyed and burned up. There was some modification of that principle in the sense that God's priests were his earthly representatives, so some of the spoils could go to them if the Lord directed that. But for the most part, the priests and Israel as a whole, they were not to accumulate material spoils or people as a result of holy war. The spoils of holy war were to be destroyed. Bottom line, the people of Jericho were not going to become Israelite slaves. They were going to be annihilated. This is holy war. So for Rahab and her family to be spared was quite unusual. On the surface, this is actually a violation of the law of Harem. Now, it's interesting that these two spies felt that they had the personal authority to spare this family. But in the end, it was because of the reality that to declare one's faith in the God of Israel is to be spared. The spies inherently understood that Rahab and her family merited this because now they were in some sense more Israelite than Canaanite. And we're going to see this same theme appear with Ruth, the book of Ruth, her mother-in-law Naomi. The spies weren't entirely comfortable in all this. And thus the long and detailed rhetoric about what it is they promised, under what circumstances, and if Rahab didn't follow all the procedures, then all bets were off. Yet the two spies knew that for their own sake, and because of Rahab's confession of faith, something was fundamentally different now. Rahab and her family were Gentiles, but they now worship the Israelite God. Does this ring a little bit of a bell? And can you see this illustration of exactly what would be professed in the New Testament? Can you also see that the gospel is an Old Testament promise, not a New Testament innovation? Can you also see that as Gentile believers, those of us who are, we are in the same strange position as Rahab? We're either fish or fowl, or we're neither fish nor fowl, but something else entirely. We're Gentiles, but yet we're in one spirit with the God of Israel. So are we Israelites with a Gentile body, or are we Gentiles with a Hebrew spirit? The arguments can go on forever. What we know is that by profession of faith in the God of Israel and putting our full trust in his Messiah, exactly how to describe us really doesn't matter, except that we are saved and we're his. Now, verse 22 through 24 finishes the story of Rahab with the words that the spies went up to the hills and they hid there for 3 days. The soldiers looked and they looked and they could never find those spies, so they returned to Jericho, and then the spies crossed back over the Jordan, went directly to Joshua to tell him everything that had happened. Now note that in addition to their report, they added what really matters the most and what they probably couldn't wait to tell their own wives and families. Truly, the Lord has delivered Canaan into their hands. The promised land is ours for the taking. Those who will oppose them are shaken in their boots. They already know they're defeated. Well, let's prepare to move on to chapter 3 as we witness a truly momentous event. The grand entrance of the nation of Israel into the promised land. For the believer, I'm not sure an event ought to stir our hearts any more than this one, except for Yeshua's grand entrance into Jerusalem on the colt of a donkey, which would shortly lead to his death and our redemption. It is far more than coincidence that a focal point of Israel's entry into their exodus from Egypt was the crossing over of the Red Sea. And the ending of their exodus was the crossing over of the Jordan River. They crossed over into the wilderness, and they crossed over out of the wilderness. And in addition, we're going to soon see in a later chapter in the book of Joshua that the Passover was associated with Israel's official end to their exodus and the beginning of their inheritance, just as Passover was also the official mark to the end of their servitude to Pharaoh and the beginning of their redemption. Now, buried just under the surfaces of these passages of chapter 3 are some principles that can be easily recognizable to a believer if you know what to look for. And I'm going to do my best to point them out as we come to them. Before we do that, however, the first few words of this chapter, which are Joshua got up early in the morning, as simple and as innocuous as they might seem to a modern Westerner, are leading me to discuss yet again the matter of how to think about the material of the Bible as we read it. In other words, we cannot approach the Bible as though we are reading a Tom Clancy novel. Nor can we read it as though we're perusing a newspaper at our kitchen table in the morning. We cannot see the Bible through the eyes of Western culture. We must adopt a view as though we are part of the cultural milieu in which it was written. We must also understand that the Greek language, the earliest known translations of the original Hebrew were in Greek, and then the Latin that the Greek was translated into, and then the English after that, are all languages that are called linear. And they're rational in nature, while Hebrew is circular and organic. Okay? To approach the Bible otherwise leads us down dubious rabbit trails, and we arrive at places that produce error-filled and rigid doctrines born of allegory and speculation. Now, there's another element, however, that also bears critical importance for a Torah student to grasp. The Hebrew Bible, I'm speaking of the Old Testament, especially was not meant to be read. It was meant to be spoken out loud and then passed along that way. Thus, the stories and the narratives of the Old Testament were created and handed down in a way that was more made for storytellers to speak them than for students to sit and silently read them. See, now that concept might hurt your head a little bit because ours is a text-based society that utilizes the written word to pass along thoughts and information. Well, now a lot of video, I guess, huh? It is nigh on to impossible for we of the Western world to conceive of an oral culture where the written word was only there for a sacred archive so that the stories that would be transmitted from generation to generation by means of storytelling had somewhat of an anchor. Now, the first real use for text to be passed along and used in textual form wasn't even to teach history or to instruct detailed aspects of a particular religious cult for the next generation. Rather, text was used for accounting records. It was used in contracts in more advanced societies and highly structured economies such as the Egyptians and the Hittites later on the late era Assyrians had. All ancient people, even those with high literacy rates, preferred the spoken word to the written word. The Hebrews of Jesus' day, well, they had one of the highest literacy rates in the entire world. It seems that it even surpassed that of the Roman Empire. All Jewish children were required to attend at least 6 years of formal schooling. Yet we hear Yeshua say, "Let those who have ears listen." He never said, "Let those who have eyes read." Most Hebrews could read in his era. Many could read Greek as well as Aramaic and Hebrew, even if it was only at an elementary level. But they preferred to be taught by means of the spoken word because that was at the heart of their culture, and this was the norm for the world. Now, this notion of various societies having different preferences to communicate information and thoughts shouldn't be foreign to us, as do many of my friends. I guess I lament this new visual video world we've evolved towards, whereby it's all any parent can do to get his child, or in my case, grandchildren, to sit down and actually read a book. They want to watch. They want to listen rather than to read and comprehend. Now, I'm not going to debate the merits of any of these methods. The point is that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, was created in a culture based on oral communication. So other than for transaction records, accounting records, all ancient documents were there to be read out loud, not read silently. This is because the vast majority of ancient documents ever found were to be transmitted to groups of people, from a small flock of three or four students to crowds of 1,000 more. So when a so-called letter was written down, it would not be handed to its intended recipient. Almost always, a message bearer would read it to him out loud. Not because the recipient was illiterate, but because the letter had been created in a manner that lent itself for oral rather than textual communication. Thus, when seen in its original and not completely masked by languages and that were created for their ability to be communicated by text, perhaps better than by spoken word, we find the Hebrew Bible is just loaded with rhyme and alliteration and poetry and songs and all kinds of various rhetorical devices that achieve that purpose. Now, once we translate those Hebrew phrases into another language, the embedded grammar and structure that allows one to tell a story, to get mental pictures drawn for them, and its essence remembered by entering in through the ears, all that gets lost. Even in our text-based culture, writers have to write in a way that pays attention to how the words of the text are going to be transmitted. A simplistic example would be a modern science textbook. To read such a book out loud to a class is frustrating, not only to the reader, but to the listener. A science textbook was written to be read silently and studied, and it loses its potency when it's read out loud to a group. The detail is just too fine. The amount of information is too dense. I would say that when read out loud, a scientific textbook is almost incomprehensible. Now compare this to children's books, such as what Dr. Seuss writes. All right, they are better read out loud than they are read silently. The writer uses word tricks, rhyming, all kinds of methods that please the ears much more than the eyes. In fact, it's the sound of the story more than the content often that pleases and is easily remembered. Dr. Seuss's books were written to be spoken. They're much more effective when used in that way. One more example. I've watched our own music and worship leaders sing a song. I've even seen one sing under his breath in order to call the song's words to recollection. He can't just recite them. You put him on the spot, he can't just recite them verbatim without the attendant rhythm of the song. Without the music they were written to complement, the words lose much of their ability to be remembered. I mean, I dare say many of us that here at times have sung that ABC song under our breath. What letter is that, ABCD? Oh yeah, E. To help us remember what letter comes after the next one. Now further, the modern practice of punctuation is really very recent. Punctuation helps to sound out written words so they can become spoken words. In St. Augustine's classic 4th century work, Confessions, he mentions that a dear associate of his, Ambrose, was one of the most remarkable men he had ever met because he could read text without having to move his lips. This is because not only did most written languages not have punctuation marks, they didn't even have paragraphs. They didn't have beginnings and endings to sentences. Most didn't put spaces in between words. This is because they were written in order that they would be spoken. And by speaking out loud, then the separations between words and sentences and paragraphs become quite natural and just free-flowing. Now, many of you are aware of a certain Hebrew Bible from the Middle Ages that is called the Masoretic Text. What makes this particular Bible so valuable is that a group of Hebrew scholars called the Masoretes saw the need to preserve the sound of Hebrew, the spoken word, because the world was steadily becoming a place of written documents as opposed to the oral transmission of stories and histories. The Masoretes developed a system of punctuation so that Jews of the diaspora and future generations who had never heard Hebrew spoken would be able to correctly pronounce the words. One final thing, and we're going to conclude for today. Part of the reason that all this was so is because the ancient world believed that words themselves had power. Not written words, spoken words had power. Thus we read that God spoke the world into existence. He didn't send a detailed memo. We read that Yeshua is what? The Word. The spoken words of a God were considered powerful and living in and of themselves in that era. Now, I don't wish in any way, of course, to diminish the wonder and usefulness of text. In fact, I don't even really want to say that the spoken word is necessarily better or worse than text. I'm attempting to point out that the form of the Bible was accomplished not in a way that was meant to be read, but it was meant to be spoken out loud. Thus, what to us, especially in the Levitical law, seems like boring repetitions, needless detail, and saying the exact thing three or four different ways is actually a style that is needed to make a story interesting, to make it memorable, and then how it highlights certain important principles within it. Joshua is told the same way. The book of Joshua is told the same way. Our Bibles that have been somewhat rewritten for the modern student to read silently cover over that reality. Thus, sometimes the point or purpose of a historical account, the choosing of which events to recount and transmit to the future generations in order that an important principle is brought to light, that can get lost because of the way we do it now. I'm going to do my best to try and draw out those hidden principles and purposes for us as we move through Joshua, then we transition into the book of Judges.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.